everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. It is our 250th episode. Holy cow. If you guys want to get in touch with us, you can drop us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. We've been tweeting every now and then. The handle is, of course, This Show Is So Gay. And go to the Facebook and join the 5,000 folks there who are hanging out with us on Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a 250th episode we have for you this week. We must get started with our first amazing guest. Dr. Eliza Byard is the executive director of GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, an organization known worldwide as an innovative leader in the education, youth development, and civil rights sectors, fighting to end bias-based bullying, violence, and discrimination in K-12 schools, and promote a culture of respect for all. For well over a decade, she has shepherded the growth of GLSEN's public education and advocacy efforts, student organizing and youth leadership development programs, professional development. She's created programs. I knew I was going to start skipping things, Eliza, because we'll never get to talk to you if I don't skip stuff.
GLSEN, it's just an honor for me to be here.
You sit tight. I got more. She serves on the Board of Trustees for America's Promise Alliance, the Steering Committee of the National Collaboration for Youth. Her work has been recognized in more forums than I can begin to list, but she was named a champion of change by the White House, and how about this, an amazing mom by AOL. Love that. She's got a ton of publications, some films she made. I'm sure she's a world-class quilter and a champion horseshoe thrower, but let's actually chat with her. Eliza, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, as I say, it's an honor to be here with you for such a milestone.
We love having you here. Now, I will tell you from right off the start, you have been ably represented on This Show Is So Gay for the past 6 years by our dear friend Mary Jane Karger.
That's wonderful. Well, if they're going to be represented by someone, I would pick her. She's been such an important part of GLSEN for many, many years at a lot of different levels, from the chapter up to the national board. So that's terrific.
We're going to start off with a little, Eliza, this is your life. Are you ready?
Uh-oh.
I know, right?
Don't tell me about this part.
I didn't tell you about a lot of things. You just wait. I did a little research, and I'm sure that Paul was a great influence on you, but I've read so much about Rosalie Byard. Tell everyone about her.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm always happy to do so. Rosalie Byard is my mother, and in fact, probably the most important person out there in terms of connecting me with GLSEN. My mother is retired now, but was a high school English teacher. And back in the early 90s, she was at Brearley, a school here in New York, and heard about this guy, Kevin Jennings, who was coming to speak. She went and heard him speak and told me the next day, you've got to find out about this thing that this guy, Kevin Jennings, wants to do. He wants to start an organization to transform K-12 schools. And my mother actually became a early founding member of GLSEN's New York City chapter.
Wow.
Now, those who don't know my mom can't quite picture this, but let me just say, the thought, I mean, I think of her going to the New York City LGBT Center here on 13th Street and walking through the ACT UP meetings of the early 90s to go to a small room in the back where a group of teachers were meeting and, you know, concerned students and teachers and parents were getting together to be an early GLSEN chapter. And the thought of my mother doing that is very moving to me to this day.
Unbelievable. Any shout out for Paul?
Oh, well, Paul, my dad was also a big influence. He was always so clear with me about the importance of getting a good education and the fact that everything that happened at school was a stepping stone to doing important things. And his big thing was always taking seriously that it was important to give back as you plan for the future. You know, get a good education, work hard, and think about how to leave your community a better place than you found it.
Love it. Now, you started off behind the lens, your movie Out of the Past, which premiered at Sundance. It won the Audience Award. It was broadcast nationally on PBS in 1998. How would you describe your own lens as a filmmaker?
Well, I was very lucky to start off in film and television early on because I was thinking a lot about the power of words and images and stories to move people to make a change. And I worked actually in the 80s. I had internships in public television. I actually got to work for Bill Moyers,
oh, wow,
an amazing journalist who was such an influence on me. His big theme at the time was really thinking about, and to this day, the conversation of democracy. And from him, I really learned about how important it is to talk to people thoughtfully with whom you disagree. And he was always seeking out different points of view. He had a show called A World of Ideas, and I remember working on a number of episodes that featured very conservative hosts that I knew Bill disagreed with, but he had them on for a purpose, and the conversations really were about how do we work together with our different ideas to make a better world. And I really respected that. That was a lesson that I carry with me to this day.
Amazing. Amazing. You went on to do your PhD in history, and I don't even care the content of this paper. It's all about the title, Inverts, Perverts, and National Peril, Federal Responses to Homosexuality, 1890 to 1956. For those of you who have not written a dissertation, let me tell you, as someone who's done it, it's all about what's going on before the colon.
It really is, and if you can have a sort of three-beat intro to what you were doing, you're fine. In fact, my friends and I used to have a little game, a parlor game of taking titles of dissertations in foreign languages and trying to predict what they said just by sort of making up what would be a good title. So you know, before the colon, we could come up with some good ones.
I'm measuring out what I did before the colon. Yeah, it was like a 3-beat colon. I'm kind of proud of that now. Well, there
That's
you go.
Very important.
So we skip ahead to 2001 when you made the decision, all right, you know, my mom's had involvement there. I've heard good things. I want to work for GLSEN.
Absolutely. I actually began getting, as you mentioned, I actually was co-producer on Out of the Past with Jeff Dupre, who really spearheaded that project. It was a great opportunity to bring together the work I was doing in U.S. history and the work I did in film to begin to provide some curricular content for U.S. history on lesbian and gay history in the United States going back to the colonial era. So I'd been around GLSEN quite a bit. After Out of the Past, we did a kind of user's guide and a kit for GLSEN chapters that wanted to use the film. Some of the shooting for the film itself took place at a GLSEN conference in Salt Lake City in 1997. So I'd been around. I consulted on a number of projects. I ran something called a research roundtable that brought together advocates and university researchers at a GLSEN conference to talk about what do we need to know about LGBT youth to try to create change. And finally, I'd worked with Kevin Jennings quite a bit, and he decided that the time had come to have a deputy executive director on the national staff, and I was honored that he asked me. It was a great, great opportunity, and I have never looked back.
No, you haven't. And in fact, let's talk about that, because we've just had the most fortunate experience and the greatest opportunity to host so many different executive directors and folks working for nonprofits over the past 6 years of doing this show. And you definitely are on the list of having stayed at an organization much longer than other folks.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I know that, you know, I love what GLSEN does, and I love what this organization is in being a network of national staff and local chapters and student organizers around the country who are working on such a fundamental issue. I mean, it means a lot that our work every day is about improving something today and building something for tomorrow. And that is a kind of satisfaction that is hard to give up. I also am continually inspired by the brave people who choose to do this work. You know, when I started on staff at GLSEN back in 2001, death threats and horrible emails and phone calls were a pretty regular part of our lives because of what we do. And we get a lot of attacks from our opponents who use us as a sort of fundraising punching bag. But, you know, there are people out there, you know, GLSEN, Kansas City and Nebraska and Houston and Tennessee, who are carrying this work forward locally. And I consider it a real privilege to try to support and amplify what they're doing and then provide them with tools and information that really make the most of the brave step they take by championing this issue every day.
Absolutely.
It's incredibly satisfying.
You know, I was going to ask you when we first booked this a few weeks ago, I was going to ask you to give me a sort of state of the schools report. And just even in thinking about that question and my own research, I would imagine that every week, you know, maybe not every week, but every month that you could be asked that, the answer would change just a little bit.
That's a very interesting point. I think that's true. I think in certain ways we've hit some incredible tipping points. You know, every one of GLSEN's recommended interventions is now endorsed as a best practice by the U.S. Department of Education. We have seen our model policies adopted by school districts and states across the country. We have seen events like the Day of Silence take root in communities everywhere. We see ideas that once were radical, you know, that LGBT people were an integral part of every school community deserving of respect and opportunity, went from being a fairly radical assertion to now being a fairly accepted reality that school districts wrestle with, sort of how to respond to this fact. At the same time, there are definitely moments when it's so clear how uneven the progress has been. Where schools are doing the right thing, students' lives are getting better.
Right.
Where they're not, we're still seeing significant trouble. And, of course, all success brings a backlash, and I think we have to be vigilant about not losing any ground. So I also am excited to see how over the years we've heard a lot from abroad, from other countries, where people are beginning to think about trying to transform schools in a similar fashion to make sure that every child has an equal opportunity and that they learn to live together in a greater state of respect and harmony. And so there's tremendous movement. I see there are definitely developments to keep an eye on in terms of backlash, but boy, it's a different world than it was when I first got into this work.
Oh my
gosh.
It's
really been amazing to be part of it.
Now, how do you see yourself in this role? The executive director role is a pretty forefront role in an issue that everyone is always talking about for good reasons and for backlash reasons. How do you wrap your mind around how you fill this role?
So here in New York City, there's a wonderful resource for LGBT executive directors. We actually have a support group here that meets every 2 weeks. And one of the most important things I ever learned when I first became executive director was from that group and someone in that group who said to me, take the role seriously, but never take yourself too seriously.
Nice.
So it's a wonderful and important balance. So here's the thing. I have the unbelievable privilege of representing these issues and representing the incredible work that my colleagues do here every day, that our chapters do, the GSAs and the students we work with. And I have the responsibility to make sure that this place runs in a way that never lets them down.
Yeah.
And that means a lot to me. So I feel like I have the incredible chance to try to be a trusted partner and a useful leader in terms of opening up new space for conversation, bringing new resources to their work, and amplifying the steps they take every day in a way that redounds to everyone's benefit. And, you know, making sure that when someone's brave enough to stand up, that we're there to help them have a target that makes sense. You know, I don't want any of that brave energy to get wasted. So let's make sure there are things for them to do that we know are going to make a difference in the long run. You know, day to day, I try not to think about the role too much, except in those moments when it's time to step up. And it's like, okay, I'll think about a chapter out there doing the work or some student that I met and think, okay, well, I may be nervous right now or I may be worried about how this is going to turn out or maybe someone's saying something nasty about GLSEN Inc., you know, the sort of gay ink part of the job. But, you know, my responsibility is to them and to do my best. So that's an inspiration for me all the time.
Well, my favorite question and my favorite topic to engage the various nonprofit amazing folks we've had on the show, you know, we do have these setbacks. There are things that happen. I was watching videos of you on YouTube just even mentioning that you've had these, it's way too many experiences of writing letters of condolences to parents.
Mm.
How do you motivate yourself through all that? And certainly as someone to whom your staff is also looking, who's experiencing these setbacks as well, how do you push yourself through that?
Well, you know, I have to say, losses like that, when you know that a young person has been lost or a school community is suffering, I always take that as a charge to really buckle down and work harder.
Mm-hmm.
I think for each time that we learn of a loss, we also hear from students who have turned to us at times and their lives have gotten better, you know.
Yeah.
It's so important that our losses serve to remind us of the obverse, of what's possible when we get there in time or a resource is available or something good happens in someone's life. And, you know, I really treasure moments when I hear from students and can share this from the staff or hear from an adult who says, you know, 6 years ago I saw a Glisten Safe Space sticker in my school. And that changed things for me. And we do get stories like that. My job is to be a conduit. If I can be visible and some student sends me an email because they know they saw my name somewhere, I can share that with the staff. And we pass it on to keep us all going. I gotta say, I mean, the worst experiences are when we can't be there in time. But in the end, I will say that often whoever's in charge sends you what you need at times of trouble.
Yes.
So often tragedy will also bring us news of the times when we really made a difference in someone's life. And you've got to remember both of those.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, look at how it's already been a decade of No Name Calling Week. It's already been a decade.
Know. Yeah, you're going to make me feel old now. Yes, it is amazing. I mean, you know, I was trained as an historian, and it's amazing to me as we follow the data in the National School Climate Survey, as we look at the long view of our project here to change a system so much larger than we are. You know, it's kind of incredible to have the opportunity to be somewhere long enough to see the arc of history begin to bend. And I really believe that we are seeing that happen. And it's taken a lot of people over a lot of time putting in a lot of hard work. But when you can begin to see it happen, when you see something like No Name Calling Week, which was a pipe dream, you know, an LGBT inclusive program for elementary and middle schools, and you see where it is now, it's pretty amazing.
Unbelievable. All right, I have my two controversial topics. Are you ready?
I'm sitting down.
Okay. The first is the Day of Silence, and I actually wrote about the Day of Silence in my Huffington Post column, and the great thing about having you on is that I am so easily influenced by you. You can set me straight in about 2 seconds. So my struggle with the Day of Silence is one that I know that you've heard before, is that, and this is where I also have to remind myself of my privilege of living in urban areas where LGBT topics and K-12 education are a little bit more commonplace, and so sometimes when I see the Day of Silence, I think, oh, but where's the Day of Shouting? I don't want people to be silent anymore. To which you, the executive director of GLSEN, say,
can you imagine walking into a school in Montana,
as
happened in 2001, and 400 students in 2001 decided to spend the day silent to commemorate what happened to their peers who were lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender?
Yeah.
Can you imagine what that would feel like, particularly for the student who themselves did not feel able to speak out, to have that kind of powerful moment of solidarity? Sometimes shouting means that individual voices get lost.
Totally.
And when you can have a community of silence come together to take a symbolic nonviolent action like that, I don't know if you've ever been in a school with a large number of students observing the day, but you feel it.
Yeah.
You feel it. I mean, how much shouting is already taking place in a school hallway on a daily basis? What makes that special? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, silence is powerful. And it's followed by a night of noise. I mean, the idea is to break the silence in a meaningful way at the end of the day. I certainly have heard that concern before, but I think that symbolic action is just, it's deeply moving. And we know that for so many students, it has been a day where they get to experience solidarity in a way they never have before.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it would be as easy to spot your ally if they were the one shouting in the hallway.
See, this is why we cover this, because I'm easily influenced by you. So that's the one thing.
I like the question, and obviously we hear it often.
I'm sure.
And I think, you know, there is a way in which silence is very, very loud.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think that the idea that taking a vow of silence on a day in a symbolic fashion is not the same as being silenced. And I think that silence makes speaking out all the louder when you do that at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, it's symbol, it's performance, it is protest and art, and it is one of the largest student-led actions of any kind in our country at this point, which is also stunning. When the students who invented the Day of Silence brought it to GLSEN and asked us to help to amplify it and take it over from coast to coast, it was only taking place on a few dozen college campuses. And I think that the message of this performance of protest in a way that is nonviolent, that is actually relatively not disruptive in the school, has really resonated over the years.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing.
Well, my other question for you, and I don't know this to be true, but I was just thinking about it as I was doing my research. Do you ever get pressure to change the name of GLSEN?
Well, I don't know that I'd call it pressure. It's certainly something we think about a lot.
Yeah. You do so much amazing work on trans issues. And as I work with more and more K-12 students, and certainly my college students who are more circulating around the word queer. And look, let's be very clear. I would have no dissertation without GLSEN. GLSEN inspires so much of what it is I do in life. But then I was thinking, oh, I'm curious if ever people ask, oh, should we change the name? Does it need updating? Does it need altering?
Oh, well, the name has changed over the years several times, but not in the last 13 years. And it certainly comes up. I think we've tried to flip it so that our name is GLSEN rather than the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network.
Totally.
And the issue of how to meaningfully include the whole range of students that we serve does come up. I think that finding the next right name for the organization is a serious endeavor.
Huge.
And we absolutely, I mean, the idea in being GLSEN instead of the words in the acronym was about sort of not foregrounding any particular groups in the name. But yeah, it comes up a lot. It is something we're really trying to figure out how to do the right way, and maybe spelling GLSEN differently would be a way to go about it. But the other way might be also to have a name that was something entirely different that didn't try to map out all of the words in the various acronyms. And, you know, that's the kind of process that, you know, finding that right name is something you need a lot of professional assistance for, which we currently can't really afford. But, yes, I mean, the short answer is absolutely. It is critical to us that we are championing trans students, talking about trans issues, moving policies that are specific to the challenges that trans students face. We work with Trans Student Rights, which is a student group that came to us last year wanting to become part of GLSEN yet maintain its identity as a trans student community and advocacy hub. You know, as I say, short answer, yes. And not the big challenge I've tackled yet. So
yeah, rebranding, not so cheap.
No.
Well,
no, it's not.
To close, I will give you the floor to extol the virtues of your staff and your volunteers.
Oh my goodness. Well, listen, I mean, you asked me why I've been at this for a long while, and as I say, I mean, I get to work with the amazing people who come to this cause. Over the years, GLSEN has been so blessed and so fortunate to be the focus for dedicated people who are invested in schools, who are dedicated to building a better future for everybody, and who really believe that work and education is the best investment to make in the community in so many different ways. And I've had incredible colleagues and partners, student leaders and chapter leaders across the country, as well as partner organizations that have chosen to work with us over the years. And many of them, you know, many of these professional associations that became our partners signed on at a time when GLSEN was a very controversial organization.
Yeah.
Next year, 2015, will mark the 25th anniversary of that first volunteer group back in Boston that led to the creation of this organization.
Wow.
And one of the things I'm excited about are some opportunities to bring past staff members together and have a reunion of sorts. It's GLSEN is what it is because it has been the work of many hands over many, many years. And that's one of the most powerful things about being here.
Awesome.
It's quite an experience.
Well, on this, our 250th episode, there was no other organization that I wanted to highlight more than GLSEN. Seriously, on so many levels, professionally for me, the resources on GLSEN.org that everybody should be going to, GLSEN.org, the resources there are plentiful and life-changing and will really help you change climates in schools to make them safer, to make them more accessible, and to be very upfront with you on a personal level. I would have no dissertation. I would have no advanced degree. There are huge parts of my life that I would not be where I am, really and truly, without GLSEN, without the work that you've done, that your staff and the volunteers have done. You guys, I love you guys.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And it was really interesting also to have a moment to reflect on my own time here. So I thank you for that, but I didn't really expect that. But it was wonderful to get to be part of your 250th episode. Many congratulations.
Well, thank you.
And I thought you were going to ask me about our Think Before You Speak Ad Council campaign in the name of your show.
Well, I don't know if you know.
We'll save that for another time.
My dissertation was actually called "This Dissertation Is So Gay," where all I did was write about that darn phrase.
There you go.
So I often let the executive directors know at the end of the call that their board is also using this interview as your next performance appraisal. So you're all set. Eliza Byard, you and everybody affiliated with GLSEN, what an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you so very much. And thanks for the chance to send a shout out to all the great people out there who are carrying this organization forward and the many people who support us. So thanks to all and to you as well. Have a great rest of your show.
You were the brightest angel heaven had ever seen. You walked in with the story to tell, 10,000 tongues to scream.
All right, folks, and we are back with our next incredible guest for this, our 250th episode. Suzanne Westenhofer has had just the most incredibly groundbreaking career as the first openly gay comedian ever to appear on television. She's been on Letterman, HBO, Bravo, Logo, GSN, as well as performances just all over the world. She became the first openly lesbian comic ever to appear on television in 1991 on an episode of Sally Jesse Raphael entitled Breaking the Lesbian Stereotype, Lesbians Who Don't Look Like Lesbians. She's been nominated for a Cable Ace Award. She's won a whole shelf full of Gay and Lesbian American Music Awards. And she will be coming to Ohio to perform at the Wall Street Nightclub in Columbus, Ohio on March 8th. Suzanne, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh my God, you made me sound so good.
You did that yourself with all that you've done.
I'm sitting there going, that sounds awesome. I would go see her.
Well, then all you need to do, Suzanne, is head to Columbus, Ohio on March 8th.
You know, and this is going to be weird. I already have flights to go there.
Look at that.
Look at that.
This is why we cover this info. We have so much to chat about. Are you ready?
A little bit.
Including, let me just do a little bit of a teaser, and I didn't warn you about this, but you'll be fine. You and I have the most incredible connection, and I can't wait to get to it, but we've other ground to cover first.
Okay.
Oh,
I'm all now.
We start with you, Suzanne, as we start with all of our funny people on our radio show. Tell everyone, tell our listeners, Suzanne, where does Suzanne Westenhofer find the funny?
In the horrifying and sad and I think most comics do. It's a, you know, some, that's what we do. We're the court jesters of the world, you know, stand up on stage and make you laugh at the things that we're probably not supposed to talk about. Nobody should know we do that. Oh my God, that horrible thing happened to you too. you know, it somehow, I just was recently even on stage, I think it was in Seattle, and somehow got to talking about the fact that, you know, it sounds like my life isn't phenomenal, and it is, because when you're on stage, you're all like, this negative thing happened, this negative thing happened. But if you get on stage, you go, the traffic over here was awesome, my children are fabulous, my partner is a dream. Yeah, that's a big boring show. That's for songwriters.
I love it. I love it. Well, tell us about that decision. Can you pinpoint that moment in time when you said, I am making a go of this?
Oh, that's such a good question because, you know, I kind of got talked into doing stand-up and I was openly gay. It was the end of 1990. And, I was doing it more like activism because I was a member of ACT UP and Queer Nation and all that in New York, New Jersey. And I was like, oh, I'm going to do this because people don't, and straight people need to hear and see that we're funny too, you know, the big giant chip on my shoulder. And I remember when I first, like, started to get paid, mind you, I'm talking like $25, but I was like, hey, this is, like, something I could maybe do, but I honestly never thought it would be my life. It took so long until I was like, I guess I'm not a bartender anymore. And I literally was making a living doing stand-up only a year after I started, so I don't know why I didn't figure it out.
What do you remember about your early, early, earliest content?
Oh, well, the one thing is I didn't know. Somehow I thought every time you got up to do your 5, 7, 8 minute sets around the city, I thought you had to have a new 5, 7 minutes every time. I didn't know that you could do your set and learn it and practice it and get good at it. I thought it had to be new stuff every time. So before a year was up, the good part was I had an hour show to do at a cabaret downtown. Like, I headlined my own show in a year because I had all this material because I was too naive and stupid to know that you're supposed to practice your routine and get better at it.
I love it.
And I had been bartending so long, I had so much to talk about.
And you covered it all, and it was a new set. Every time folks came to see you, it was something new.
Exactly, but I didn't know that it was New York City, 10 million people, and the truth is it wouldn't be the same people.
I have to tell you, I tried my darndest to find a clip of you on the Sally Jesse Raphael show. I could not find it.
Oh.
Is it out there?
Well, I know that in my attic there's VHS of it.
I'm coming over. I am coming over. I can only imagine, because this is what I did. So I went online. I'm like, all right, I'm going to find it. I'm going to find a clip of it. And I couldn't, but I located these Sally Jesse clips from right around the same time where she had drag queens on. And it was so horrid to watch that. I got a little nervous what your experience was like.
It was not, you know, we are different now. It sounds weird, but at the time it was all very groundbreaking and very positive. The subtitle of my show was Lesbians Don't Look Like Lesbians, which would be so offensive now.
Right.
But in 1991, that was, isn't it amazing? And really just that time in like 24 years, we've changed from thinking that that's okay to say lesbians who don't look like lesbians, and she's going to have on me and a few other women who are gay but, quote-unquote, look straight.
Yeah.
Like, that was okay, and we were proud to do it, thrilled to do it. I was very bold. I was funny. I was excited. I had big, giant spiral perm hair, you know. And now that would be, I can't even imagine the lesbians would lose their
They would. They would, except that I think that you should bring the VHS with you to Ohio, and we'll have a viewing party, and it'll be a discussion afterwards. Look how far we've come.
Oh, my God. it makes me want to find it and find a way to put it out there. I know that there is a piece of it. I know there are pieces of it in documentaries. That's all
right.
All I know.
All right.
But, yeah, I should find it and find a way to put it on a DVD just for the... I don't want to say historic so much as I want to say hysteric.
I'm sure. I'm sure. Well, look, I said in your intro, you have performed all over the world. You love doing cruises. How many cruises do you think you've done?
Ooh, you know, I just got home from one, and I remember somebody asked me that. I'm going to go with 40.
Wow. I have never been on a gay cruise in my whole life.
Oh, honey, you must.
They scare me.
You must be on the water with your people.
I know. It's the way to bond. It's the way to bond. So you've been all over the world. I love asking this of folks who have just these incredible careers like yours. We'll go with the highs and the lows. What was one of those times that you just walked off that you still think about and thought, man, I killed it?
I can't even say that this was about killing it. I will tell you that I performed 10 minutes of stand-up in Yankee Stadium at the closing ceremony for the Gay Games, 1994.
Nice.
What was so astonishing is, you know, comedians, that's more of an intimate thing. You know, you don't want more than 1,000 people at a comic show.
Right.
You can have, you know, it's about us having a conversation. Being at Yankee Stadium, being on a stage set at second base, turning in the middle of my set and seeing my big face on the Jumbotron like Madonna. You know what I mean? I was like, and hell yes.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. Now, I would imagine you've also played in some incredibly small venues where I don't think that there were crickets, you know, but maybe it was a harder sell.
I've been really fortunate. I don't have a lot of really, it's very funny you asked me that. I'm reading a friend, a folk singer, she wrote a book and she's asking me to read it to give, you know, a blurb at the end. And she's writing about, you know, her early years. And I'm sitting here going, I am such a spoiled brat because I never had to stay in communal housing or open for horrible people or schlep across the country. I started out on the road really in 92. And I was only the headliner and treated pretty well, you know. So I feel like I should never write my book.
There you go.
It'd be like, you know, it'd be like, oh, I can't believe I had to stay in a Radisson instead of a Hilton. that would be bad, right? That would make me sound bad. And I'm a fairly decent human being. I swear to God, I'm from Pennsylvania.
I love the idea that you're going to write this book and there's going to be a whole chapter called The Ice Machine Was Empty. And that was like the
right,
big drama.
Exactly. No, there's going to be two whole chapters going, I can't believe I'm in Coach. who are these people? Where's my warm nuts?
Buffet diversity? I don't think so. Yeah. I love it.
And it's, you know, and of course, I get such grief about anything I ever, you don't mean to become a snob when you go on the road, but if you go on the road, I have a new partner. She's never really traveled on the road except in college as a basketball player, you know, which is a group of gals and buses staying at Motel Sixes. Do you know what I mean? She traveled with me this last year. And in 1 year, she went from being the person going, honey, don't worry about it. We're sitting in the back, but that's okay. You know what I mean? To, like, I can't believe this hotel's house. And I'm like, look what happened. I can't believe room service ends at 11 o'clock. What is wrong with these people? It's horrible. It's horrible what we become out there.
Now, did you have this moment? We've had so many comics on the show, and it is a particular lifestyle where a lot of your peers have reported that they had that one point where they had to convince themselves to keep going. Did you have that kind of seminal moment?
Not yet.
Look,
I love it.
I hope. Can it not happen during this interview if it hasn't happened yet?
And I'm finished. I hate you. My career sucks. Goodbye.
I am moving on from that. Okay, this brings us to our ridiculous connection. Are you ready?
I love this so much.
It's
I'm so excited.
It's so I random. It's so random. And
we used to date, didn't we? Are you my prom date?
So close. By the way, you're not that far off. But I put out there on Facebook, I said, look, we're doing our 250th episode. Here's who's going to be on. And a friend from high school said, oh my gosh, that's amazing that you're having Suzanne Westenhofer on, that you were able to get her to talk about her experiences in our high school. I said, what are you talking about? And she forwarded me a New York Times article about how in 1993, you, Suzanne Westenhofer, were in my high school health class.
Oh my God.
This has got to be ringing a bell, right?
Yes, of course. I did this for like 2 years when I was still living in New Jersey. I went up and down any high school that would take me, and I went in, you know, to answer questions.
October 15th, 1993, the name of the New York Times article, and you can get it, folks. You can get it right online. Meeting Gay Bias Face-to-Face, Teenagers Get Direct Answers. This was my health class in my high school, Pascack Hills High School. I have to tell you the first couple sentences because it's so great. The human visual aid for teaching teenagers here about homosexuality is Suzanne Westenhofer.
Love it. Hey, wait, can you see the picture?
I don't see the picture.
Okay, if I remember correctly, this is going to horrify you a little bit as a gay man. I believe I'm wearing a floral vest. I believe I'm wearing... Oh, my God, I'm a human visual aid. I love that. I do remember. I know I have... I mean, I'm sure I have a copy of the art. I have, you know, some boxes of... You know, you get boxes of stuff that you think... Well, if I get famous, I'm going to want to have all this great stuff, you know what I mean?
The interesting thing is, first of all, I completely blocked it out, and in thinking about it more, well, because I will tell you, there's no way that I, as the closeted guy in high school, there was no way that I went to that class. I didn't see you, because I'm sure I avoided it like the plague, because I didn't want to be anywhere near associated with that. But here's the piece. This is what killed me.
Look how different it is.
I know. This is what kills me. This is right from the article. Quote, a roommate, Ms. Westenhofer recalled, shunned her for years after she declared her lesbianism. Mm-hmm. It was the worst experience of my life, Suzanne said amid welling tears. It could happen to you. You could have a gay brother. What would you do? John Contreras, 17 years old, said, shoot him. John Contreras, let me tell you, Suzanne Westenhofer was totally my high school bully, and I read this article. I'm like, I didn't make it up. This really happened. It was oddly validating.
Oh my God! Hey, we have to find him.
I know. I tried. Do you know someone said you should totally get him to conference? You and Suzanne should conference him in, but I can't find him.
That's because some gay guy killed him.
Right. Well, no. Someone said he's doing nonprofit work in Brooklyn. I don't really believe that, but that's okay.
Whatever.
that's what we say about all North Jersey kids. But no, in all seriousness, so you were traveling up and down. I know you were traveling up and down in New Jersey doing these presentations. What prompted that?
After being on Sally Jesse Raphael, a woman who taught at a Jersey high school asked me to come in, if I would come in and talk to the kids, because believe it or not, that show was like a controversy.
Yeah.
I mean, the Sally Jesse Raphael show got mail about it. It was like good and bad, and it was like a really weird thing because I said things you weren't supposed to say. That was back in the early 90s when we were still apologizing for being gay, when everybody, even activists, would say things like, do you think I chose this?
Right.
I can't help, I'm gay. And I didn't say that. I said the opposite. I said, I'm so glad and I chose it and I want to be, and it's like winning the lottery and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It made people really nervous and upset and happy. So this woman called me and she asked me if I would come in and talk to her high school class, and it just sort of mushroomed, you know, and I would love to still be doing it. I think now that I'm older and kids are so different, it would be like, if they go, you're Suzanne Westenhofer, an open lesbian, and they'd be like, just like my aunt. You know what I mean? Like, it would be so lame. Right?
Well, you had...
I have two moms.
You had these really just amazing exchanges, which just so speak to the time, so where you were taking in people's questions, and they asked, this is right from the article, do you want to sleep with Christie Brinkley? No, Suzanne said. Cindy Crawford, they asked? Nah, she's not my type. How do I explain? You may have a girlfriend and think she's cute, but your best friend thinks she's a dog. I think Martina Navratilova is hot and Candace Bergen. That's from Suzanne Westenhofer.
There you go. Oh, my God, they quoted me.
But it's just amazing. I read this and...
It's my sweet little way of saying, I'm a femme, I prefer a butch girl. Can you imagine me saying that? Look at it, 28 little faces going, what?
Well, I will say, in response to John Contreras, 17 years old, saying that he would shoot his gay brother, the room fell silent, and Suzanne Westenhofer sighed and said, I've got a lot of work. With that attitude, I'll always have a career.
Yeah, wow.
I'm bringing you back.
Okay, first of all, the fact that he was your high school bully, that you were there, I mean, this whole thing, I almost can't wrap my head around it. It's so awesome.
I know, and I actually was telling my mom about this, and she said, that's the most incredible story. I said, I know. And because you always think...
It's the most incredible story.
Well, because you always think, all right, you talk about your high school bullying experience, and maybe I exaggerated some of it. It was, you know, it was a solid 20-something years ago. And then I read how, in response to Suzanne Westenhofer, he said he would shoot his gay brother. So, oh, I probably didn't make that up.
You were completely validated, but also, aren't you just going, what the what?
Yeah.
I mean... Oh, my – I mean, come on, dude. That's just like – and we got to find it now.
I know. You and I, we're on it. We're going to sit him down, and we're going to watch this VHS together.
Okay, so this is my cell phone. You have to text me his name. /John.
We're doing it.
I'm on mission from God.
Well, we do have a couple other things. We're moving on from John Contreras, but we'll come back to him. We'll come back to him.
Gay kid.
He certainly has no brothers left. So, yeah. Now, I will tell you
–
I will tell you, you had what I consider to be my dream job. I love my job. It's super fun. I love being a college professor. Yay. But I have always wanted to be like Charles Nelson Reilly, and you got to do it by being on a game show.
It was the coolest thing ever.
So for folks who don't know, Suzanne Westenhofer, a regular panelist on the reinvention of the classic
one, yeah.
I've Got a Secret. I've watched clips of it. I remember watching it when you were on. That had to have been a dream.
Okay, it was a dream. It was a blast. Everybody there, and talk about small, weird things. The guy who was the executive producer was a little nobody producer on the Sally Jesse Raphael show.
Oh, my gosh.
When I was on it. The world gets smaller. It was the most fun ever. Everybody there was like a fan of those old shows. So that was, except for Billy Bean, who was an athlete, you know what I mean? He's still an athlete too. He's like, television, what? You know? he, as a young gay man who could play ball, he actually went outdoors during the day.
Whoa.
Whereas the rest of us fags stayed inside.
Nice.
But we had a great time. You know what was the saddest part about this? And this is just the way it is. We were watched by enough people to keep the show on, but the people that watched were too old.
Wait, I don't even know what that means.
Well, what it means is like, you know what, like when they do, oh, 1 million people watch the show, or 500,000 people watch the show, or 10 million people watch the show. But it really doesn't matter how many if they're the wrong age.
The wrong demographic,
like if over 50 or over 60, then advertisers don't care. And so even though we had like the highest ratings on Game Show Network at the time, so we were just thrilled. We thought everything was all hunky-dory. And then all of a sudden it was like they did some sort of marketing. They did some sort of polls. And they found out that too many people that watched our show were in like retirement living.
Oh.
And we were all like, but retirement people, like they should have good television too. Apparently not.
I'm telling you, if somehow I could turn back the hands of time and get on Match Game, I'd be set for life.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I grew up and I thought, I just forgot her name, Brett.
Brett Summers.
I thought she was a goddess.
Yeah.
With her deep voice and occasionally smoking a cigarette and seeming like she might be a little bit half lit.
Oh, they all were, yeah.
Oh my God, it was genius. And that show was so gay, and we were young and we didn't know, but all those like little, you know, double entendres.
I'm the idiot going to high school in 1993, watching reruns and telling people that I want to be friends with Fannie Flagg. They didn't get it.
Oh, you are awesome. No wonder you got bullied, you little
John Conoratis, nonprofit in Brooklyn, apparently.
Let's find him. That story may be one of the world's greatest stories in my life.
It's our 250th episode. We got to break him out for this.
It almost is like, if you and I were sitting and hanging out and had Thai food delivered, I'm not saying I'm hungry, I'm just saying that occurred to me. And we were watching a television show, and that was on the television. We would go, that is so gay, that would never happen. Right? Why do they always do these things? You know what I mean? Why do they always make up these kind of like, oh, and then the bully was actually in the club? You know what I mean? And we would be like, oh, this is so badly written. Who wrote this?
And you have to think about the logistics, by the way, because I've been thinking about this a ton, and keeping in mind that I had completely blocked this out. I needed to have someone send me the link to say, I had no idea that happened. But you figure in the article, because folks, we're going to increase the traffic of this article, that many of the students did not sign the slip to have their names revealed to the New York Times. John Contreras obviously went out of his way to say, yes, I'm John Conoratis, 17. Please print my name and spell it correctly.
And spell it correctly because I'm a and I would like for everyone in the New York Times to read this.
Right.
Proud. You know what's funny, too, is I remember doing all those classrooms and stuff, but obviously I don't remember specifics. But now what I remember, too, is that the way he was slung into his chair, the arrogance.
Oh, yeah.
It came back to me like, bam. I wouldn't be able to pick him out of the lineup, but I remember that. Because I remember thinking, oh, someday in the real world, a woman is going to love him, and he's going to be horrible to her.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
But now he's the executive director of the LGBT Community Center in New York City. Yeah, I don't know. We'll find out what he does.
Yeah, I know, right?
We'll find out.
Well, you know that does happen. I hate to, you know, we hate to admit it, but sometimes the biggest bullies turn out to be, you know, it's that inner homophobia, and they turn out to be gay. But,
But who knew that little Kenny Schneck talking about Fanny Flagg would turn out to be gay? What a surprise.
Yeah, see, that's shocker. Shocker. I rolled my eyes. You can't see that on the radio, but I rolled my eyes.
It makes for good radio. Well, the last thing I would love to touch on with you is, my gosh, the number of benefits and just fundraisers that you have put your time and energy into is just incredible. How do you go about choosing which causes? I would imagine that regrettably you have to say no every now and then.
You try. It's one of those things like where you have to like put yourself in what, like, I'm a woman, I'm a lesbian, I'm pro-choice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you have to see which things are like the and which things already have so much money, and get the time or who asks the nicest?
Right.
You know. Or who's smart enough to look at my schedule and go, well, look, she's already going to be in Cleveland. You know what I mean? And then they, you know, and then it's like, oh, well, you can't say no. That would be like, oh, no, I'm not going to do it even though I'm already there. Like, I'm not a horrible person. Mostly, mostly if they can gather up enough money to, you know, get me there and put me up, you know, and maybe a little walking away money, I try to say yes to everything because, you know, I'm openly gay for a reason. It doesn't seem as important now, I'm sure, to a lot of people. It's 20-some years later. But the whole point of just not doing stand-up and being a straight girl and then getting famous and maybe coming out, the whole point of being gay right from the start, that was very specific. I did that on purpose.
Yeah.
To raise awareness for the world. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
And maybe it wasn't my smartest move. And maybe I don't have a TV show because of it. I don't know. I don't care. I got to go to bed at night with me.
Yeah.
You know, I got to think that, you know, my mom is proud. Things like that, you know.
You have unquestionably made a mark. Everyone needs to stroll on over to SuzanneW.com. You don't have to spell out her last name. She's got the domain name Suzanne.
Nice.
Yeah, she's got the domain name SuzanneW.com. She is going to be at the Wall Street Nightclub in Columbus, Ohio on March 8th. So you can go check her out there. Look, do you entertain people? Without question, Suzanne. But my gosh, do you make a difference with how you spend your time and your energy and just how you make us laugh and how you make us think. And as you just said, the very intentional choices that you have made that have made such a difference, obviously, for so many different populations. And unquestionably, on a personal note, for this, our 250th episode, you've made a difference in my life. And I'm just so appreciative.
You're moving me very hard, and I'm supposed to be a bitter, jaded, funny, dark comedian, but I want to say that it means a lot when someone says that, because it's what I wanted to do. I'm honest. I wanted to make it easier, and if I made it easier for people, that was, you know, that was the whole point.
There you go. Suzanne Westenhofer, what an absolute treat having you on the show.
And I have a feeling we're going to see each other.
No question.
Did I do that?
No question. No question.
Hear the rock show winding down at the high school. Kids out on the sidewalk waiting for rides. All the punks and the queers and the freaks and the smokers feel like they'll be waiting for the rest of their lives.
All right, folks, a few thoughts here at the end of, again, our 250th episode. First, let's talk about next week. On next week's show, one of our favorite guests. I know I'm not supposed to say that. They're all my favorite guests. I love all of them. But again, as I've said on previous episodes, one of the amazing opportunities of doing this show is that I get to talk to some of the same folks year after year after year and build these relationships and get to know new facets of these amazing projects they're working on. And on next week's show, for the fifth or sixth year in a row, I'm not even sure what it is at this point, Mariah Hansen, the founder of The Dyna, the lesbian extravaganza there happening in California. She will be on the show. She will pressure me yet again to come to California and go to The Dyna. And I thought I was going to do it. Now I'm not doing it. So I got to break that news to her, and I'll do it on the air because it's my safe place. Also on next week's show, the founder of the groundbreaking Paz magazine, Sean Strub's going to be on the show. So it's going to be great to have the two of them. So many other exciting things coming up. There's even the possibility, I'm breaking the news right now, there's even the possibility of there being a new co-host on the horizon. A new co-host on the horizon. That means that I don't have to do the news by myself anymore, and we can devote more time to just going back and forth and talking about what's going on in the world. I'm so excited about that, and I know you will be so excited about that if this works out, which I hope it does. So we'll be testing that out this week. More to come on that. No real grand reflections on our 250th episode. We did bells and whistles on our 150th episode and certainly on our 200th episode. But on this, our 250th episode, as I mentioned last week, I just wanted to do business as usual, where we have incredible guests. I did up the ante a little. I've always, always, always wanted Eliza Byard on the show and to represent GLSEN in this incredible way. And Suzanne Westenhofer, as you heard, what a personal connection I have to her and her actually being in my high school. It's the craziest story. So I'm so happy that went off like that. But at the same time, it's just what we try to do week in and week out. You guys can get in touch with me. If you have guest ideas, I'm always looking for new folks for the show. I love having returning guests on. Certainly we do have some new folks on, but you know of people that I don't even know about. So send me an email, send it on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. You can pitch yourself. If you're doing something really cool to use your voice to create just the most amazing opportunities for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters, come be on the show. Let's talk to you. So send that email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. And of course, go to thisshowisogay.com, subscribe to our show on iTunes, just get it downloaded into your iTunes inbox every single week, and just join us. We love having you. I would not do this show. I get a ton out of it. I get a ton out of doing this show. The fact that you guys listen, that just makes this even more worthwhile. So I thank you for listening for the past 250 episodes. Here's to another 250. We're going to just keep on going with this show, and we will do it with your support. So thank you guys so much. Get out there. Go do some incredible things. Use your voice the way you know how to use it to lift up your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there doing it, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?